KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
...were not constructive, that the union has, quote, dug in and has resisted the agreement between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice. And the report says infighting among command staff has become a concern. Bob wrote that the new interim chief, Jim Pugel, will provide a, quote, window of opportunity for SPD to accept the federal agreement and comply with it. He praised a weekly meeting of command staff that reviews uses of force, although he said they could be more rigorous. And he said a similar meeting that reviews use of firearms appears to allow comments and procedures to protect an officer. Bob is scheduled to speak at City Hall today at 3 o'clock. Meanwhile, Seattle is planning to melt down more than 700 guns from a buyback program in January. Mayor Mike McGinn is expected to announce today that the melted guns will be turned into bricks with a peace message to be placed around the city. The 716 guns will be turned into bricks with support from the charitable foundation of famed glass artist Dale Chihuly. The mayor plans to visit public schools around the city to hear from students about how gun violence affects them, and their messages of peace will be represented on the bricks. And a town hall meeting is scheduled for tonight on Seattle's Climate Action Plan. City officials see the plan as a key piece in helping Seattle become carbon neutral by the year 2050. The public meeting will be tonight at 6 on the second floor of University Heights Center. This is KUOW News.
KUOW's Jamala Henderson. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:06. 54 degrees in Seattle, mostly cloudy. It's going to be sunny later, and we should get up into the mid-70s. Support for NPR comes from the Pajamagram Company, offering women's pajamas in gift packaging delivered overnight and for Mother's Day at pajamagram.com.
Support for KUOW comes from Gordon James Fine Diamonds in Bellevue.
KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve Scher is on sabbatical. I'm going to be in the seat for the next 5 months. Coming up this hour, some new music recommendations. We're also going to take up what it's like to be, and what it was like actually, to be an actor in the early days of television. Michael Fagan's here with a weather and a hike, and, you know, a whole lot more gardening coming up in the second hour of the show as well. The U.S. Senate yesterday gave overwhelming support to a bill that would raise taxes. The so-called Marketplace Fairness Act requires online retailers who do more than $1 million in business every year to charge sales tax, except in states like Oregon that don't have a sales tax. For years, the fight against online sales tax was led by the world's biggest online retailer, Amazon, and then Amazon changed sides. So what happened with that? Joining us to sort it all out is Matthew Iglesias. He writes about business and the economy for Slate.com, among other outlets. Hi, Matthew. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
Well, first, let's just start with what happened yesterday. Was it a vote, or what exactly happened?
Well, there's been what's called test votes in the U.S. Senate, which sort of see what's the measure of support for a bill. It's not a final enactment, but the question is, you know, is there going to be enough support in the House of Representatives for this legislation to move forward? It's clear that the Senate, you know, is prepared to sign off on this.
Who, as I read, there were 74 senators who were highly supportive, 25 who opposed it. Who at this point is in the opposition?
Well, in the Senate, the main opposition is from senators who come from states that have no sales tax. So even some senators who are generally quite liberal, such as Ron Wyden from Oregon, are against this bill because they see it will take away a sort of advantage that their state has under the current system. In the House of Representatives, it's different. It's a bit of a more ideological battle. And it just seems that conservatives are, you know, adhering to the general anti-tax philosophy of the Republican Party and are very hesitant to vote for this bill. Now, it remains to be seen. In the Senate, you know, large physical retailers, your Home Depots and everyone else, sort of made their voices heard through the normal business channels that exist and got a lot of Republican support. We haven't seen that yet in the House of Representatives, but we may in the future.
So at this point in time, well, for over the years, it has been the bricks and mortar retailers like Home Depot who have been asking that a sales tax be levied to even the playing field, so to speak. Amazon for years opposed that idea, and then all of a sudden this behemoth switched. What happened?
Well, so what happened is that Amazon has been a main company that's taken advantage of the difficulty of collecting online sales taxes. They're obviously the biggest online retailer. But what started happening is when they would put physical facilities in different states, warehouses and distribution centers, that would become a target for taxation. State governments would say, you know, we're going to make you collect sales tax if you want to have this physical facility here. And Amazon for a long time, though, had been flipping the script on that and been saying, hey, look, we're going to only put this distribution center in your state, creating jobs, helping the local economy, if you agree to exempt us from tax rules. So that had been their sort of their main strategy. But as Amazon has gone on, they've decided that, you know, they really want to get the best in the world at delivering, that too many other companies now can throw up a website where you can order stuff and then they ship it. And Amazon really wants to sort of rule the space of doing speedy, efficient online deliveries. And that means that they can't afford to keep monkeying around with their warehouses. They want to put the stuff where it's best to serve customers. And that's going to mean that they are going to end up getting taxed, and they want to make sure that all major online retailers are taxed if they're going to have to pay taxes.
We're talking with Matthew Iglesias, who covers business and economics for a number of outlets, Slate.com among them. This bill is a little bit complicated because it's businesses that do $1 million or more a year who are subject to this, correct?
Yes. I mean, the most straightforward thing to do would be to say something like, there's a new federal sales tax and internet retailers have to pay it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, that's not how the American system works. Sales taxes are collected by state and local governments. So this is a bill that is going to force online retailers to engage in a kind of record keeping that will allow states and cities to collect sales taxes from them. Doing that record keeping is logistically difficult. I mean, when online retailers say that the logistical difficulty is why they don't want to pay taxes, of course they're being disingenuous, but it is true that it's hard to do. And so there's this fairly generous exemption for small companies that have less than $1 million in sales, so they don't need to worry about it. Bigger companies are going to need to go hire an accountant. eBay, which is one of the largest companies that's leading the opposition to this, has been pushing for a bigger exemption.
Now, is it up in the congressional purview because it's interstate commerce as opposed to being regulated just state by state?
Well, exactly. So Congress is saying that as the interstate regulator, they're going to say that if you want to ship across state lines in the United States, you're going to have to comply with these procedures that make it possible for different state governments to collect the taxes the different shoppers owe. So Congress will not actually be taxing anyone or creating any new taxes. They're creating an enforcement mechanism that state governments can piggyback on to get the money that they're owed. Now, see, under current law, typically states maintain in theory that you do have to pay sales taxes on stuff you buy over the internet. Just nobody pays them and there's no way to check. So that's the idea here, is to create an enforcement mechanism.
Theoretically, we're supposed to be self-reporting our purchases, right?
Right, exactly. You're supposed to keep track of everything you bought and say, you know, I got this stuff, I owe you this much in taxes. nobody does that. But the idea is that, you know, you would want to enforce a tax like that by going after the retailer and saying, hey, you guys aren't ponying up the money. But if the retailer is not physically located in your state, then how can you do it? The answer is you need a federal mechanism, and that's the idea here.
So, for example, in Washington State, or at least in the county where I live, in Seattle, King County, sales tax is quite high, over 10% for a lot of things. As you mentioned, in Oregon, there is no sales tax. In Michigan, it's 4 or 5%. So each retailer is going to have to keep track state by state by the percentage of sales tax.
I mean, they're going to have to keep track of where they're shipping things to. That part shouldn't be too hard. I mean, presumably, if you're shipping stuff, you have some idea of where you have shipped.
Well, so I guess what I'm asking, I asked it badly. If I live in Seattle, if I buy something that's shipped from Kentucky, are they charging me the tax that I would pay if I purchased it in Washington State or if I purchased it in Kentucky?
It'll be the Washington State.
Wow.
Tax. So, you know, so residents of high tax states are going to see a big hike, and residents of low tax states or states with no tax are going to see no increase. You know, the flip side of that is that for a state government like Washington or New York City is going to get a lot of extra revenue from this, whereas mm-hmm. a state that has no sales tax is going to get no extra revenue. So it's been interesting how it's played out. I mean, you might think that it would be the senators from states like Washington who are leading the charge against this, people saying, hey, I want to spare my constituents from this large tax increase. But that's not the case. It's going the other way. It's that people who represent states where the state government isn't going to get any extra revenue about this are very, you know, eager to block the bill.
But that's interesting to me because their constituents would not be paying sales tax.
Right, but the issue is that they see no benefit in it, and their local retailers also don't really care about this issue.
So the fact is that this seems like it's an inevitability that despite some opposition in the House, business, by and large, with the exception of people like eBay, they do favor it because bricks and mortar stores are looking for a fair advantage.
Exactly. I mean, the retailers have finally put together a winning political coalition here. It's quite possible that the House of Representatives won't pass this bill anyway. House Republicans do a lot of weird stuff from time to time. But the coalition will still exist even past the midterms. There was an overwhelming bipartisan majority in the Senate. You know, if the House for some reason doesn't act, it'll happen next Congress. I mean, it seems that a consensus has developed that, you know, you need to work out a solution that spares the very smallest electronic retailers, but that helps the brick-and-mortar retailers regain some kind of parity here. Because, you know, everybody knows that the big-box stores have been hit pretty hard. You know, the internet shopping is not brand new anymore. People aren't afraid of it. And so they don't want to be at a price disadvantage along with all the other problems that they're facing. And the genius of retail as a lobbying enterprise is that, you know, there's retailers in every single state and every single district all across the country. Everyone has outposts of the big retail companies. They also have local retailers, you know, and those people know how to make their views heard in Congress.
Well, of course, the home of Amazon, as you mentioned, the biggest of the online retailers is probably 3 miles from where I'm sitting as I have this conversation with you. And it leads me to speculate on beyond the time that an online sales tax is implemented. Let's just assume that's happening in the next year or so. What does it say about the shape of online retailing? What can we expect to see? Is the emphasis going to be customer service?
Well, I think that Amazon's change of philosophy on this issue shows that they're changing their business strategy, that it's not anymore for them about trying to undercut brick-and-mortar retailers based purely on price. Obviously, they still care about price, but I think Amazon sees that they are winning the war against brick-and-mortar retailers. They're looking to the future where they're going to have to compete with other websites, whether that's Walmart doing ramping up its e-commerce or some new startup to compete with Amazon. And Amazon wants to say that they are the best in the world at shipping and delivery, and that they can get stuff to you as efficiently and as quickly as possible, and that nobody else can match them. And that's why they wanted to stop paying this. They wanted to stop playing this cat and mouse game with local tax collectors and say, you know, we're going to focus on our business. We're going to build the outlets where we want them to be. And then what we want is a tax system that anyone who tries to compete with us in online retail is also going to have to pay because we're going to end up paying.
How much of a hit are the million-dollar businesses, the smaller online retailers, going to take if this is implemented?
Well, I'm not sure that they're going to take a huge hit. The question looking forward is going to be about the growth of firms. You know, if you're there, you have $900,000 a year in sales, and you're thinking, you know, how hard should I work on seeking out some new opportunities that aren't going to turn me into the next Amazon, but might, you know, increase my business by 15%. If increasing your business by 15% is going to require a lot of hard work on your part, but also is going to create a lot of extra compliance costs, you may say, you know what, it's not worth it. I'd rather spend more time with my kids. I'd rather take a longer vacation. You know, and so that's the concern we should have. I mean, it's very sensible. It's very human. Not everyone running a small or medium-sized business, you know, wants to dominate the world, but they do want to think about how to grow. And when you put big sort of caps on how on what happens to you when you grow a little bit. That doesn't mean, I think, that a lot of business owners sort of ramp down into a kind of complacency. You know, it's not the greatest tragedy in the world, but it has some impact on the economy over time.
Matthew, thank you so much for taking time to explain this a little further past the headlines for us.
Thank you.
Matthew Iglesias is business and economics correspondent for Slate. He's also written for Think Progress, The Atlantic, and The American Prospect. This is 94.9 KUOW.
It's 9:20. A conversation with early television actor Jan Merlin in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Laird Norton Wealth Management, celebrating 75 years of King County Parks by establishing the King County Parks Foundation, devoted to strengthening families and connecting communities for generations to come. Information on contributing at ourparksourfuture.org.
Okay, let's get this show on the road.
Come see how radio is really made.
Ow!
Radioactive summer session applications are open for youth ages 16 to 18.
Oh, and then this is where I have that awkward silence because I forget that it's my turn to talk.
Apply online at kuow.org/radioactive.
Support for KUOW comes from Nissan and the 100% electric Nissan Leaf, whose drivers have driven more than 150 million miles gas-free. More at NissanUSA.com.
54 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 74. These morning clouds should go away, revealing a mostly sunny sky later. New music recommendations from Liz Riley of Seattle's Three Imaginary Girls in 15 minutes.
From KUOW Seattle, KUOW.org, I'm Marcy Silman. Jan Merlin's an actor from radio, television, and film. He's also an Emmy-winning screenwriter. He starred in early TV shows like Tom Corbett, Space Cadet, and The Rough Riders. He's in his 80s now and retired from acting, and Katie Sewell sat down with him.
Yeah, we met at his hotel room while he was visiting Seattle while a huge thunderstorm was raging outside. You'll get to hear that during the interview. He enlisted in the Navy during World War II, serving on three successive ships. Once the war was over, he got involved in theater classes and very, very quickly landed himself on Broadway. I asked how he made the leap from Broadway to television, but he thought that that question was getting a little too far ahead in his story.
Actually, this story is really, how did I get on Broadway in the first place? I'd gotten through with my courses at the Neighborhood Playhouse, which was a two-year course. You know, we were all people fresh out of service, and the young ladies were all wanting to be actresses, so we were in heaven. But we were also poor. After I'd finished with my courses, I was down to about 15 cents. Still had a phone. Was living in a cold water flat that cost me 14 bucks a month. The phone rang on a Friday. I was thinking, gee, you know, they don't need a torpedo man. I can't get a job. I've got to get some kind of a job. And I thought maybe I'd look at Western Union or something come Monday. And the phone rang, and it was the gal from the Neighborhood Playhouse, the secretary, and she said, Joshua Logan, who was then... He had the biggest hit on Broadway, the Mr. Roberts. Joshua Logan is casting a new show, and they're looking for military types, and I think you better get over there. So I charged out of the house. It took a dime of my 15 cents to take the subway up to the Alvin Theater, and there were about 4,000 guys standing in line waiting to get into the back of the theater to see the people casting. And they divided us in groups. And, we went through in larger groups and then finally smaller groups. And each time I was retained. And then I went in with a group of four people. And we were on the stage of the Roberts set. And just the overhead light on. The theater was dark. And they said, all right, boys, take your shirts off. And we took our shirts off so they could see our manly chests or whatever. And they were quiet for a while, and then somebody came up to the apron of the stage, and it was Joshua Logan, and he looked up at me and he said, I've got a boy leaving the cast of Mr. Roberts. Which show would you like to be in, Mr. Roberts or South Pacific? And I was stunned. And I said, well, Mr. Roberts, because I can't sing. And he said, have you seen the show? And I said, no, I couldn't afford it. He said, you'll see it tonight. Tomorrow, Saturday, you'll come in, rehearse with the stage manager, and tomorrow night you'll go on. And that was how I got my first Broadway show. And I was with it for 2 years. And all of us were thinking, my God, here we are with the biggest hit in town. We would like to get a raise. And we asked the producers if we could have a raise. We had them have a meeting with us after the show one night. And they thought about it, and same thing. Josh came up to the stage, and he said, gee, fellas, we'd all like to put aside a little bit for a rainy day, but we just can't do it. And from that moment on, almost all of us except Henry Fonda started to look for other work. And somebody told me about a television show that was going to be on, and it was about space. And I thought, okay, I'll go up and see them. And the moment they saw me, they had me read for the lead of it, but I wasn't right for that. They had me read for another character, and it wasn't right for that. And they had me read for the third character, and it was just perfect. A real kind of a rough guy that was sort of likable, but he had a chip on his shoulder all the time. And I got into the show, and it was called Tom Corbett Space Cadet. Was also done on radio on NBC. We did it 3 times a week on television and then twice a week on radio. So it was an exciting kind of 3-year deal. Then I got nervous because they began to put us into the comic strips. And there I was looking at myself in the Sunday Funnies, and I thought, this isn't going to work because I don't want to be a space cadet. If you ever play Dick Tracy, you're Dick Tracy forever. You play Tarzan, you're Tarzan forever. I'm going to be stuck. I wanted to be an actor. So I quit the show. Quit the show twice. I quit it once in spring of 1952, and then I quit again in the spring of 1953. This time I meant it, and I organized a production of a play off-Broadway of Rope, and the critics just raved about it. And as a result, somebody from Universal hired me to play a kid in Six Bridges to Cross. And in the film, the kids would grow up to be somebody else. Emilio became Tony Curtis, who was in the grown-up version. Well, we were that's a lovely sound. It hasn't rained where I live for a long time. In Boston, we were running around playing and shooting the first part of the show. And at night, crew would go and belly up to the bar at the hotel. And, well, I bellied up to the bar, too. I was 26 then. I was playing a 15-year-old kid. And the director looked at me and says, how old are you anyway? And I said, I'm 26. He says, well, you can play yourself as the older character, couldn't you? And I said, why not? He says, you're going to Hollywood. And that's how I got to Hollywood.
Wow.
And then I became everybody's bad guy. And I was a cowboy for 10 years. I was a German and a Russian, all kinds of spies for 10 years. And I was a gangster for 10 years. And I had a wonderful time. I've had a marvelous career.
Did you like playing the bad people better than the good?
Oh, yes. The bad guy's the engine of the show. He's the reason the whole show exists. The hero, we know he's going to go off with the girl, and I got to die 50 million times. After a while, it got so that I thought, if I'm not horizontal, nobody's going to recognize me.
And speaking with Jan Merlin, as a thunderstorm rages outside, he's an actor on radio, television, and film. He started his career on Broadway after he got out of the Navy in 1949. Let's go back to the golden age of radio and the television show Tom Corbett Space Cadet. Tell me how it was different when you guys were filming the TV show to how you were directed different when you were on the radio.
Well, that's kind of a pleasure because you had to learn all your lines for the live show. And as a matter of fact, that's how I became a bad guy in the show. We had a situation where Captain Strong was floating out in space, And the other cadets wanted to go out, suit up and go out there and get him. And Roger, which was me, didn't want to do that. I had an idea about how to go back to the Space Academy and get help, and we'd get him then. But I had a long speech to say, which was all filled with this stuff Willie Ley loved to give us, all this scientific-type stuff. The cue line came, "You mean to say you'd leave Captain Strong out there to die?" And I didn't know what to say, and I said, "Why not?" I could see the guy in the control room trembling and shaking his fist, and we gradually worked it back to the show. And from then on, Roger was more than just a cocky guy. He was kind of almost a meanie, but never, because he always did come through at the end.
So it was a luxury with the radio show because you didn't have to memorize anything.
That was wonderful because you didn't have to memorize at all. And it was sheer pleasure. I loved doing radio. You could be all kinds of people and characters because the people imagined what you looked like through the sound of your voice. Mm-hmm. And if you could be different and offbeat, they'd get that offbeat thing you were going for instead of just seeing you as you were.
So did you do lots of other radio shows besides that one?
No. I didn't have the chance to. After I got into the Hollywood thing, I was busy as a bird dog. I never got signed to any studio because I was making much more money just running around being a freelancer. As a result, I worked at every studio in town.
So how do you end up making the transition? You won an Emmy for writing for Another World, and you've written a whole bunch of books.
Oh, wow.
So how do you make the transition to being a writer?
When I was in the Navy, I despite the terrible times we had, I had times when I wrote just because I wanted to write, and I used to write poetry and things like that. It stayed with me, and I had written a book about, people kept saying I should write about the war, and I couldn't, but I almost did. I wrote a book called Brocade by Avon. It was originally called Ainoko, which is what I have it titled now. But Brocade was partly me and partly not me. I used essences of things that happened to me just before we entered. I was with the first group that went into Japan's inland sea, and our squadron of destroyers cleared all the mines out of it, and we anchored off of Hiroshima for quite a while. I remembered going ashore with sidearms for the group, and we went ashore, and it was an extraordinary and terrible experience and kind of wonderful experience because we'd been fighting with them for 4 years, and the last taste of them was still clinging to us from the whole Okinawa thing. It was extraordinary. After seeing all that ghastly wreckage, on the other side of the mountains surrounding the city, there were untouched villages. And I'd went into one where there was a theater, and there were pictures in front of the theater, and I was struck by that in a funny way. I guess I was meant to, and I was born in a Russian Orthodox church in New York City, and we had a basement apartment, and behind the apartment was a theater, a place where they put on plays and things, which I never dreamed I would become an actor, but I remember seeing plays when I was a kid. So here was this theater, and I saw an old man with a child between his knees, and he was teaching it something, movements, and he was intoning something. I was really curious about it. And I kept going back to that place day after day, and they invited me in once when they had some kind of a production going on. I couldn't stay there long because I think those things last all day. And here were all these people. On the other side of the hill was that disaster, that terrible thing. It They were watching a show. And it took them away. They could lose themselves. I don't want to write about it. I love acting because it's an escape for me and for everybody that watches. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That was actor and writer Jan Merlin speaking with Katie Sewell. Merlin was a star of film and television in such early shows as Tom Corbett's Space Cadet and The Rough Riders. You can hear that again later today at our website, kuow.org/weekday.
It's 9:35. New music recommendations in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle University's Albers School of Business and Economics, offering graduate business degrees for working professionals. Next information sessions are on May 15th in Bellevue and May 16th in Seattle. More at seattleu.edu/albers/graduate.
Well, that's nice. That's lovely. The first thing you say to me as soon as you get me off on a train away from my family and everything is that you don't like my hat.
I'm David Sedaris. This week on Selected Shorts, the witty Dorothy Parker from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from LeMay, America's Car Museum, which celebrates its first anniversary with a June 1st gala. The evening features musical entertainment, cars, catering by El Gaucho, and a preview of the new Legends of NASCAR exhibit. Details at lemaymuseum.org.
54 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Expecting sun this afternoon and a high of 74. We'll get a more extensive weather forecast and a hike to match the week's weather in 15 minutes.
From KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. You ever find yourself in a music listening rut? Well, we do too, so we decided to launch a new regular segment that we hope will introduce you to new music in a variety of genres. And today, to kick off this new segment, we invited Liz Riley Tollefson into the studio. She's co-founder and editor of 3imaginarygirls.com, which is a music, film, and arts blog in Seattle. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be here.
So I think we're just going to launch right into the music, and we have to start with this band from Bellingham with the greatest band name ever. Is it Gila or Hella Goats?
I think the consensus is that it's Gila Goats.
Gila Goats, like sun as opposed to helicopter goats.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought it was Hella Goats for the longest time, and then somebody set me straight, and I've gone with that ever since.
So who are they?
It's led by a fellow named Chris Optepka.
Boy, so the band is hard to say, and so are the names of the musicians.
Yeah, but he's worth it. He's a really great guy who blends music that's part mountain goats, part built to spill, with a whole lot of like Clem Snide folkiness to it. And a lot of his songs are more on the folky side, but he comes out with some jams, and this song is one of them.
Let's hear a little Bernard.
One.
So this is a very, I can tell you were thinking about sunshine, Liz, when you picked this song to bring in.
Yeah, I picked them when it was just getting a lot warmer and the our outlooks were getting just brighter. And that song, it's, the song is also hard to say.
I was going to make you say it. That's why I'm just avoiding it. Dreizig.
Dreizig, yeah. I found out it's Yiddish for keep moving.
And that's what it sounds like. Mm-hmm. Is there a Bellingham sound? Is this evocative of that, or is this just unique to this band, Heligoats?
I would like to think that everyone in Bellingham sounds like the Heligoats. And if that's the case, then I would say that it's a lot humbler and more straightforward, no condescending tone to it, and just I just imagine people with guitars playing in living rooms and having a great time.
Maybe it's the carefree Bellingham lifestyle.
Yeah.
Something like that. This is from a new album, though, right?
Yes. The songs were released back in March, but in a couple weeks, on May 21st, the vinyl version is going to be released thanks to a Kickstarter campaign. So the people have spoken, and we want vinyl.
Well, now we're going to play something that I think of as very evocative of a Seattle sound. This is a band called The Purrs. The tune is from their album, The Boy with Astronaut Eyes. The song's called Rotting on the Vine, so you'll see how I'll pronounce this one. So I'll say it. And I was trying to figure out why this seemed so Seattle to me. Is it the chord progressions?
It could be that. It's also fuzzy and a little bit foggy, kind of like our weather is most of the year. And I thought it was, and also they've been around for 10 years, so they've certainly made their mark and just imbibe a Seattle-ness to them. I always thought they were a little bit, they're swirly, shoegazery kind of psychedelic pop. Definitely very confident in what they're doing, which is Seattle.
This is their seventh album, and it's on a label called Finn.
Mm-hmm.
What is this? Are they looking at this kind of music in general on this label?
I've gotten a bunch of releases from this label recently, and they're all very strong. And they're very distinct in their own way. And this one is the swirly shoegazer release that I've heard from them recently. And I'm really excited about that label.
Based in Seattle? Is that where?
You know what? I'm not sure. I actually don't, because they're also releasing another band that I was going to bring, but I didn't want to have them monopolize the whole segment, called the Cali Giraffes, which feature Kim Warnick of the Fastbacks.
Who doesn't live here anymore,
I understand. Yeah, in Portland, Maine. And so I'm still considering them a Seattle band, because I think most of the band members still live in Seattle, but I'm really just so happy that this band, that this record label has decided to let these songs see the light of day.
So this particular album, The Boy with Astronaut Eyes, is the seventh album for The Purrs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've been very productive in 10 years.
So is this a band that is doing a lot of touring nationwide, or are they really focused on a regional audience?
They have toured around, but I believe that they're the strongest in Seattle and the Pacific Northwest, especially the Pacific Northwest, with Portland, Oregon, has the Dandy Warhols, which I think also feed into this sound. Not that they are copying them at all, but I think that they would make great touring partners.
So the sound, as of Liz Riley Tollefson, the swirly shoegazers.
Mm-hmm,
That's the swirly shoegazer sound.
Swirly shoegazer pop.
That's a new one on me, and I like that a lot. The last band we're going to listen to is a song that just seems so very Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the band is you call them a Seattle-Tacoma band, so we'll just say a local band. The group is called Boat, and this is a tune called Inside an Aquarium.
Mm-hmm. for the test results to come back. With a full tank of oxygen, how many ribs did you crack?
Well, I know it's not funny, but the lyrics, so the lyrics are about a car accident because it's raining.
Because it's raining so much. And the lead singer lives in Tacoma. The rest of the band lives in Seattle. And so there's a lot of driving back and forth. And I assume a lot of hydroplaning.
So do you think this is based on a true story?
I like to think it is, just because it's happened to all of us. And so the fact that somebody's made a song about it is comforting that it's not just me.
I guess not, but it's funny to juxtapose some pretty serious words with what seems like a very lighthearted tune. I mean, very poppy, very catchy kind of beat.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing the Smiths do with the very sad lyrics and the very happy beat. But I was one of the reasons this song is, I was singing it a lot this weekend, is they have the line, "You cried until you realized it was good just to be alive." And that's just a great line to just have going through your head when it's so sunny and so wonderful. And it's just a great time to be in Seattle.
So just to widen out our discussion, these are three tunes, and you can find out more about them at the website, threeimaginarygirls.com, mm-hmm. and at KUOW.org. We heard from Gila Goats, and Gila Goats, I will now say it correctly. That album is called Back to the Ache, and the song, boy, oh boy, Dreizig, which is Yiddish for...
keep moving.
Keep moving.
And I really like the way you say that. It's much better than I would say.
Dreizig. We also heard from the Purrs, the boy... with Astronaut Eyes is the name of the album. The song's called Rotting on the Vine. And actually, the Purrs are going to have a release show.
May 10th. Friday?
At the High Dive. So this is a brand new album. You can get in on that. And the tune that we just heard from Boat is from the album Pretend to Be Brave. The song was called Inside an Aquarium. And this is the... Is this from the fifth album?
Yeah, the fifth album.
Mm-hmm. So just a little, to widen it out a little bit, Three Imaginary Girls, what are you guys looking for when you feature music?
You know, the great thing about running a site solely on passion is that we can just pick whatever we want. We don't have to worry about making anyone happy or, you know, filling in any favors. And so if we're happy about it, we write about it. I usually veer towards the jangly, very jangly, happy indie pop kind of sound. Twee or Boat is called Sloppy Pop. I love my Sloppy Pop. And then we also have writers who are into power pop, which is, you know, with the Posies, is very big in Seattle. And then we also have sad bastard, you know, bearded rock fans on the on staff. So we each have our own little niche that we fill and write about. And if you read about it on the site, it's basically because we can't contain ourselves and have to share it with everyone.
So when you're looking for new music, and I mean, now you have your blog, but if you, before you started that and you were just sort of out in the world, if somebody does feel like they're in a rut, what would you recommend? Where should they go? What should they do?
Well, I'm a big fan of local record stores and just going in and saying, hey, my favorite band is Bruce Springsteen. Tell me who the next Bruce Springsteen is. Or I love Led Zeppelin, you know. And I just remember before the White Stripes hit it big, I had every friend that ever said they love Led Zeppelin, I sent them the White Stripes CD. Just you will love this. And believe you me, you will be glad you got this CD this early.
One thing I noticed about your website is that you guys are sort of looking ahead at all the summer festivals, and it seems like you're very, very jazzed about Bumbershoot this year.
Oh, Bumbershoot is going to be amazing. We're trying to figure out like what we're going to see each day and how we're going to divide and conquer. There is so much, because not only is there great music, but the comedy pieces and the spoken word pieces, and it's pretty amazing this year. They've really outdone themselves. It's going to be hard to wait.
So this was all new music that we've been talking about, but Liz Riley Tollefson, we're going to go out with an oldie. You included Buzz 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 by Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers in your list. And what made you add it to a list of brand new music?
Well, it's I think that it's a great summertime song, just because it's about love and gaiety and fun and sunshine. And I've just been listening to it a lot. My 6-month-old son loves it. So we listen to it on repeat whenever he's feeling a little bit down. So that means it's a happy song for mom, too.
Okay. Raising a Baby on Jonathan Richman. Liz Riley Tollefson's co-founder and editor of the website 3imaginarygirls.com. A lot of music. There's also information about film and arts and calendars there. And she has kicked off a new segment that we're going to have here on
Weekday. I am so honored.
We're happy to have you. And we're going to go out with Jonathan Richman. And just to let you know, we're going to have the names and songs online in about an hour or so at kow.org/weekday.
You see, buzz, buzz, buzz goes the honeybee, but tweedly, tweedly, tweed goes the bird. But the sound of your little voice, darling, that's the sweetest sound I've ever heard. I say, buzz, buzz, buzz goes the honeybee, while tweedly, tweedly, tweed goes the bird. Buzz, buzz, buzz goes the honeybee, but tweedly, tweedly, tweed goes the bird. Let's go out into the clover now. Here we are, up in Maine with the grass growing. And buzz, buzz, buzz goes the honeybee. And tweedly, tweedly, tweed goes the bird. But the sound of
you. So you can tell Jonathan Richman was writing that before we had, you know, hive collapse disorder. A lot more bees. Well, it has been bee weather, a lot of flowers blooming. Stupendous time for outdoor activities. Might be some high elevation avalanche with all the sunshine and temperature changes. But in any case, we have once again invited Michael Fagan to join us with some hikes and weathers. And hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm good. There's no sun, I don't think, yet, but I hear it's supposed to be sunny this afternoon.
Yes, it's coming back. It's taking a little break. It sort of got worn out the last couple of days after the record high yesterday of 87 at the airport. Now we're back into the more typical weather, but, you know, marine layer in the morning, then sun in the afternoon. That will be the pattern in Seattle through Friday, highs in the mid-70s, maybe low 70s. Rain might return on Sunday, but we won't worry about that right now. We have two great hikes. We're going to be focusing on flowers, and we're going to stay out of the snow with all the avalanche issues. We have several hikes, both in the East Cascades. The first one is Ingalls Creek, right by Blewett Pass. And this is a classic hike to get in for several weeks of May. The wildflowers are just out in full force. And this is not a long hike. You can just hike in 3-4 miles, minimal elevation gain. Again, you won't find any snow, and you have a view of the creek, forest, and plenty of flowers. And you'll need a forest pass and Green Trails Map 210. Now, if you want to do extended trip, if you can take off a couple days, it'd be a good time to head to Lake Chelan, because that's another hour from this trailhead. And you go up to Lake Chelan. What we did a couple weeks ago, we drove up to Chelan Butte, that has wonderful views of Lake Chelan, Sawtooth Mountains. You can walk up that road if you'd like, but we took the easy way. We drove up that. And then we went over to Echo Ridge, which is a wonderful area. Lots of flowers out right now, open views. We did this hike called Shoe Hike, and it's just a short 2.25-mile loop, minimal elevation gain, lots of flowers, lots of great views. You don't need a forest pass for that one. We also have a map of the trail system around there. And then we stuck around Lake Chelan and did some wine touring. So lots of activities to plan for, and if it does rain on the west side over the weekend, this area should be dry. So,
Michael, I've got to ask you, why do they call it the shoe hike?
If you look at the trail map, it looks like a shoe when you do the loop.
Oh, so it's not something about wearing out shoe rubber or anything like
that? No, and you know you're at the trailhead. Someone was cute enough to plaster a kid's shoe by the reader board by the trailhead.
So this is a no-miss hike. Any particular kind of fitness level required for this particular set of hikes?
No, they're both really great kid-friendly hikes. Again, we're talking the first one, Ingalls, it's 3 or 4 miles one way, minimal gain. You're in the forest, so the sun's not pounding on you. Now, the shoe hike, that is out in the open, and probably best to get that hike in the morning and bring plenty of water. Mm. But it's not, that's only 2 1/4 mile total hike. Now, there are a bunch of other hikes, and again, I put all the maps, Echo Ridge, you can do a lot more. So just be aware on the Eastern Washington hikes with the sun mm-hmm. baking on you to some extent. Just be aware of maybe doing those hikes earlier in the day and bring plenty of water, but they're not that strenuous. That's what's so good about them.
That sounds good to me. And you referred to, we both referred to the fact that at higher elevations, because we've seen this hot weather and because there's been a lot of snow up there, the snowpack is kind of unstable right now, right?
Right, right. There's been several high avalanche warnings over the last week, and there's been some accidents as well. So we're just basically, the next couple of weeks, we're going to be focusing on, you know, this is wildflower time in the East Cascades. So we're going to focus on that and stay away from the snow right now because there's definitely some major issues, that's for sure.
Well, right now, also, just for folks who aren't planning to take that nice little 3-day trip and head over to Lake Chelan, we're supposed to see temperatures in the low 70s this afternoon and tomorrow afternoon after that marine layer burns off.
Right. And then even Saturday in the city, highs in the low 70s. Slight chance of showers late in the day on Saturday, then a better chance of rain returning on Sunday. So by and large, we'll see plenty of sun. In fact, if you go up to Snoqualmie Pass right now, there's plenty of sun up there right now. So we're just getting the marine layer in the city.
Well, Michael, thanks for joining us.
You bet. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Michael Fagan is with West Coast Weather LLC. His blog, Fagan's Weather World, suggests good hikes to match the weather forecasts. And you can find that at hikewashington.net. And now, the sound of the day. No, it sounds like Rip Van Winkle, but it is not. It is the sound of Josh and Betsy's 5-year-old pug. His name is Ernie B. He grumbles and snores after a long day. So do I. Oh, my goodness. Oh, Ernie B., I hope you're dreaming well. What interesting sounds are you listening to in your world? We'd love for you to record 30 seconds of whatever you're listening to and send it along to us. It could be snoring or laughing or music or whatever. Send that sound to us with the story behind it. You can email to weekday@kuow.org with sound of the day in the subject line. And please be sure to include that so we know what you've got in store for us. In store for you in the next hour, Green Day's gardening panel coming in. Also, the Interfaith Amigos on the role that doubt plays in faith. And we're going to talk more about why Microsoft is doing a major overhaul to Windows 8. Not a great seller. So, Bernard, that's all coming up.
All right. It's 9:58. When is a gun not a gun? When it's a brick for peace. KOW's Lisa Brooks will tell us about Seattle's plan for the guns it collected in the gun buyback program in the news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Art Museum, presenting Rembrandt van Dyck Gainsborough, The Treasures of Kenwood House, London, featuring a collection of European masterpieces. Closing May 19th. Museum open Tuesday through Sunday. Tickets and information at seattleartmuseum.org.
This is a test of the emergency alert system.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.